This is Golf Nuts with Aaron Abrams and Jimmy James. Welcome to Golf Nuts with Aaron Abrams and Jimmy James. We're excited to have you here. We're going to kick off another podcast for Black History Month. And we are so happy to have with us in this virtual studio, or coming on up, Pete McDaniel. Jimmy, tell us a little about Pete. How do you know him? Who is this guy? I've done some Google stalking, but what's his story?
Well, Pete and I were introduced to a mutual friend. You've probably heard me talk about Billy from Philly before, although Billy is not really from Philly. Billy is from Virginia. He lived in Philly early in his career and now lives in Delaware, but Delaware is close enough. And Billy from Philly is such a cool moniker that we just all still call him Billy from Philly. So Billy is very, very steeped in the golf game, very well connected in the golf game. And he introduced Pete and me. I, of course, knew about Pete, heard a lot about him, read Uneven Lies, and have wanted to catch up with him to understand more about his story. We've not met in person yet. We've talked over the phone, but really seems like a really, again, like all of our guests we've had so far, very down-to-earth guy, very steeped in golf history. He and I have a lot of mutual friends also. So a lot of friends in the industry that he's in that I also know.
So here's what I've seen, just sort of some Google stalking though. I just want to maybe like get to some semblance of a bio here, because Pete is a journalist, I guess.
Yes.
Right? And he's written and he's done some documentaries about the history of African Americans in the U.S. golf. I actually watched, and I know you did as well, this documentary that he did called Uneven Fairways, which I highly recommend people check out. But I think what's lesser known about him, and what I didn't realize until I started my research, is that when you watch the HBO documentary about Tiger Woods, Pete is throughout
Pete is the
that
man.
Documentary.
He's the man.
So that's what I want our listeners to just Google him, so you see Pete's face and you'll see what you'll immediately recognize him from extensively, like probably as much as any person in that documentary. Pete is in it.
Yeah, I think that documentary was like a coming out party for him, because he's a reporter, he's a journalist, he's a behind the scene guy. And that very much put him in the forefront. So we can talk to him about that, his engagement with that and what that was like. And of course, about his relationship with both the Tiger Woods and Tiger's dad, Earl Woods,
yeah.
And how that all came about. So I'm really looking forward to it for so many different reasons. And I know we will not have enough time
to
talk. And Pete lives here in Georgia. He's
okay.
He's only about 30-40 minutes from me at most. So
cool. All right. Well, let's not waste any valuable time here, but I do just want to quickly thank, as always, this season's sponsor, Arcos, the technology that helps you understand how far you're hitting your shots. And I just want to say like a lot of golfers sitting here in the winter. And I know you don't know what the winter is down in Georgia, but up here we've got this thing called the winter. And so we're not playing any golf. And I'm in the simulator looking at all the numbers. And I've been hitting in the simulator. And it's really interesting, all the data that gives you. And I can't wait to get back out there with the Arcos after being in the simulator, just because I think that there's going to be a lot of overlap between the data that's there. And I hope that it leads to maybe some slightly lower scores for me. Anyhow, if you're interested in checking out Arcos, get on the website. There's a promo code, which gives you a 15% discount, Golf Nuts. And with that, let's see if we can get our technology together and bring Pete into the virtual studio.
Yeah, I get all these sounds around me from going off here. So let's bring Pete in and dive right into the conversation with him.
All right, so welcome back, and we've got in the studio Pete McDaniel. Really happy to have you here, Pete. I don't know if Jimmy gave you this background, but this is now our third season, and we kind of try to do some kinds of thematic shows that lead up or that are released at least during Black History Month. We actually just recorded a really cool one with my friend Mark Whitaker, who
Pete knows Mark.
Yeah,
I do.
So absolutely. So that was pretty cool. And I'll admit that when Jimmy booked you on our podcast, your name wasn't one that I recognized right away. But then when I Googled your face, I knew immediately who you were from that Tiger Woods documentary. You've done a million amazing things in your life, and you were in that documentary, and that's how people are gonna come up to you in every bar that you ever walk into the rest of your life. But how did it come to be? I mean, let's just jump right into that, and then we can go into the meat of your life. But what connected you with the Woods family, and then how did you end up with such a prominent role in that HBO documentary?
Well, I go back with Tiger and his family to 1994. I was in my first year at Golf World magazine, and I was a staff writer, a senior writer. And Tiger had just won the first of three consecutive U.S. amateurs. And I had some editors and, managers who were very forward thinking. And so they dispatched me to Stanford to do a cover story on Tiger. It was my first cover story. He was being named the magazine's Man of the Year. And so I fly out to Stanford, and I interview him, and I meet him at the golf pro shop, at the golf course. And we talk for a few minutes, and then we go into the restaurant, and he orders a stack of pancakes about so high and a glass of orange juice. And I'm sitting there, and I'm very prepared for it. I've got a list of questions about so long, you know. And I start asking him these questions, and he's woofing down those pancakes. And he'd answer the questions by saying yes, no. And then he'd say, what do you mean by that? And so about 5 minutes into the interview, I realize I have absolutely nothing. And so I asked him another question, and he kind of looked up at me and kind of smiled, that big smile, and started giving me these great responses, I guess as if to say, okay, I've checked you out. You seem like you're legitimate. So turns out it was a great interview. And as we're leaving, he goes down to the practice range, and he's trying to impress me by hitting these low hooks and, high fades and stuff like that. But I'm not that impressed. I've followed some really great players and written about a bunch of them. And so I thought he was just a cocky little dude. Fast forward to about 3 or 4 weeks later, and the story appears in Golf World, and I get a telephone call from Earl Woods. And Earl says, Pete, great job on the story on my son. Really enjoyed it. Said, how busy are you going to be in the future? And I said, well, Earl, I'm covering the LPGA. I've got the colleges. I've got a TV column. I said, I said, why? He said, well, I was thinking about writing a book, and I thought I might ask you to help me write it. And I said, on second thought, Earl, I'm not that busy. So we started working on Training a Tiger. And now we'll fast forward. About a couple years, Tiger wins the Masters in 1997, becoming the youngest player to do so. That's on Sunday. And on Monday, Earl and Tiger are on the Oprah Winfrey Show. and Oprah is reading from Training a Tiger, words that I had written. And the book went to straight to number one on the bestseller list. And after that happened, Earl called me and said, Pete, guess what? You will forever be linked to the Woods family. And I have been linked to the Woods family ever since. You know, I've been writing, I wrote Tiger's Instruction for Golf Digest for what, 15 years, followed him around the world, had the good fortune to write, co-author his book, How I Play Golf. And, you know, he wrote the foreword to my book, Uneven Lives. And, you know, we've just been, that's been my guy. So that's the story.
Crazy. Jimmy, I know you have a million questions, but before we move on, because it was actually something that I noticed as I was reading about you, Pete, is this, that you effectively ghost wrote for Tiger in golf. Was it, which golf magazine was it? Golf Magazine, Golf Digest?
Golf Digest.
So, you know, for those of us who are listening to the podcast, you know, you read those articles all the time. And it actually never occurred to me until I just read today that you were the ghostwriter, that they don't write them themselves. But I'm curious, as you were writing for Tiger, like what was that process? You know, if the article is about how to hit your flop, you know, your wedge as high as Phil Mickelson or something, whatever it is, like, mm-hmm. does he give you a couple bullets and then you write? Like, how does it actually become pen to paper?
That's the way it started in the beginning. You know, we do a photo shoot every January in at Isleworth, and I would have a list of tips. And he'd give us like an hour and a half to do all the tips and a feature story, okay? Phenomenal photographers that we had at Golf Digest. I mean, they were so darn good. He loved them and they loved him. He'd come in dressed and ready to go. He'd warm up and we'd run through all those tips, okay? Well, the actual tips themselves, in the beginning, I would call Tiger and he'd give me just the basics about how to play this shot, you know, how to hit a high fade or how to hit a flop shot, as you said, the key to putting and making must make putts, that kind of stuff. Well, that lasted about 5 tips. Then I had to call Butch Harmon. And to be honest with you, Butch Harmon taught me more about the golf swing than anyone else that I work with. And I work with a lot of people, including David Ledbetter and Hank Haney and you know, just everybody on the masthead, as a matter of fact. But that's how they were done. And for years and years and years, I'd call Butch, and Butch would tell me what was going on for that tip. He'd tell me exactly how Tiger played it. And then I would write it in Tiger's voice. See, I hung around Tiger long enough to know I got his verbiage down, you know, and his mannerisms and how he would, you know, emphasize certain phrases and stuff like that. So, but I wrote them in a very simplistic way so that the average golfer would understand. And that is what made him successful. I'm almost sure that Judy Rankin told me that. She said the reason they're so good is they're simple. And that's the way I wrote.
Did Tiger ever read them and then were they already like, would he okay them before they went to print, or did they go to print and then he would see them? Maybe. Okay.
So let's back up a little bit, Pete, and uh-huh. get to how you got to where you are. Mm-hmm. See, we're around the same age and all, and we grew up at a time when America was a little different than it is now, and opportunities were a little different. I think I remember you saying, like me, you're old enough to remember the whites only signs, the colored signs. You grew up in Asheville, in North Carolina. And I grew up in Texas, which I thought was the South until I lived in Louisiana later, and saw that Texas was more the Southwest. But give us a little bit about your background and the evolution of the game as you've seen it through your eyes as a sports writer and through your life's experiences covering golfers. And we'll get into some of the things you talk about in your book, Uneven Lies, which is a really heartwarming story of and history and recording of African-Americans in golf in America. So we could start with with Pete at a young age and then just sort of walk us through it.
Well, I grew up in the country. I actually grew up in Arden, North Carolina, which is a suburb of Asheville. It may be incorporated by now, but back then, and it was rural. And so my brother and cousins and I, you know, we played basketball, football, baseball, big baseball fans and big baseball athletes. We played just about everything. Biltmore Forest Country Club was about, I'm going to say about 12 miles from my home. And my brother and cousins, since they were older than I, you had to be 12 years old to caddy there. My parents were friends to the caddy master. And so my brother and cousins, they went out and they started caddying and started bringing home a few dollars. And I was intrigued by that. And I was 11 years old. And my parents allowed me to go out and see if they would allow me to caddy. And the caddy master said, come on, and that's how I got into the game. I started out as a shag boy. And for your listeners who might not know what a shag boy is, it's kind of a glorified human golden retriever. You know, you have those shag bag, which is a little small bag of golf balls, and the player stands on the practice tee, and you take the ball and you empty it out at his feet, and then you run out into the practice range, and he hits balls to you. And I got so good after about maybe a month caddying that I could actually catch the ball in the bag. You know, I catch it behind my back. I was a basketball player. I was really a skilled athlete. Like, you couldn't tell it now, but I was pretty doggone good back in the day. And so one day I caddied, and I'd made maybe about $5. And I was getting ready to go down to the caddy lot from the
clubhouse. In just a moment, that's when $5 was probably like $50 now.
It was to me, that's for sure. And this older gentleman stopped me, and he had, I think it was like 3 golf clubs, wooden shafted golf clubs, mind you. And he said, young man, here, take these and see what you can do with them. And I was overjoyed. I took those golf clubs home. My brother and my cousins and I we live in the country, remember, we live right across the road from a cow pasture.
So just for clarification, mm-hmm. So I grew up in the country running barefoot through fields, yelling at cows and pinstripe Dickies. But we know that terminology, the country. Why don't you explain for our listeners what that term really means, the country?
It means that you grew up in an area where you grew your own food. We had gardens, we raised hogs, we had something called a smokehouse where you took your meat and hung it in this little shed-like thing. You lived off the land, basically.
If you didn't grow it, raise it, or shoot it, you didn't eat it.
That's exactly right, yeah. And my father worked
Hold on one second, guys. So let me get this straight. The two of you guys grew up and it was, and I, you know, I know Jimmy's background grew up very, very poor, but it wasn't like a grocery store or any, like what about, I don't know. I'm thinking of like basic staples like butter and things like that. You made all that stuff yourself. You didn't go to the store for any of that kind of stuff.
No. I can't tell you about Jimmy, but yeah, my mother used to go to the grocery store, but she did churn her own butter sometimes.
Yep.
Absolutely. My father loved buttermilk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I couldn't stand that. They would take buttermilk and mix cornbread in with it. I'm sure you're...
I did it with what they call sweet milk. Uh-huh. I would put my cornbread in the sweet milk and they even add a little sugar to it. And that was a meal. You know, we had pinto beans and rice and stuff like that. But yeah, we were country people, but we did go to the grocery store occasionally. My father he worked at Christ School. And Christ School is famous. It's a private school. And a lot of politicians and lawyers and people like that, their sons and attended. It was an all-male school. And he worked in the dish room there. So he brought home some food, too, occasionally. But anyway, I'll get back to the golf story. We made a five-hole golf course in this cow pasture. And every day after school, during school, or after we caddied, we go play five holes around and around. And it had a creek through the cow pasture. And the reason that I'm one of the best bunker players you will ever see, even to this day. I'm an old man now, and I can still get it up and down out of just about any greenside bunker. It's because in the summertime, that creek bed would recede and leave like a sandy bank. Now I had a 5-iron, a 7-iron, and a 9-iron. And I would take that 9-iron, that wooden shafted 9-iron, and open it wide open and hit bunker shots off that doggone creek bank. And that's, you know, how I learned how to play bunker shots. But anyway, I played junior golf. I was the only Black in Asheville playing junior golf, and I competed with country club kids. I have an article that a friend of mine sent me from when I was like 14 years old playing in a junior golf tournament, and I finished third. I think I shot, it was a two-day tournament, so I think I shot 83, 78, something like that. And, you know, I was very competitive, but, you know, the kids, the white kids hit this draw. You know, they played the draw. I played, Jack Nicklaus was my hero. He was my idol. I loved the way he played. I loved champions. I always gravitated toward guys who got the job done. So I played a power fade. Didn't have a whole lot of power behind it, but it was a fade. But that's how I got into the game. I played basketball and golf in high school. And I tell people, my claim to fame is not so much that I was Tiger's writer. It was the fact that I was the heir apparent at point guard in high school to Roy Williams, the North Carolina basketball coach. Yeah, Roy and I were teammates. He's 2 years older than I, so he was a starting point guard on the varsity, and I was a starting point guard on the JV team. But, you know, I thought I was good. I thought I was, going to be a player. That was my goal. I wanted to be a professional golfer until one day I went to the Muni, Asheville Muni, and I saw these cars, these Cadillacs and Lincolns and stuff lined up, lining the entrance to the golf course. And as I got closer, I saw about a dozen Black golfers dressed in the most outlandish outfits that you've ever seen, all red, red hat, red shoes, you know, red slacks, red shirt, all white, all green, all blue. And it turns out it was Jim Thorpe, Chuck Thorpe, James Black, Jim Dent, George Johnson. All of these great Black players were playing in the Skyview Open. I stood up right behind them. They were hitting practice shots, warming up to go out and play in the Skyview Open. And every one of them hit these little bullets, like just like little tight draws. They went out like And I'm standing there, my mouth is wide open watching these guys. I never hit a shot like, I never seen a shot like that before. And I'd never seen a black, golfer who could hit a golf ball like that. And that was when I realized that I was not going to be a professional golfer. That I better sharpen up my writing skills because I was never going to be that. First, I learned that I wasn't going to be a pro basketball player because I was only 5'11", and I had the white man's disease. I could not jump, so that was the end of that. Then I learned I wasn't going to be a professional golfer, so that's how I got into writing, and I went to school for it. I majored in literature at UNC Asheville, and, my claim to fame, another one of my claims to fame is that I never filled out a resume. I graduated from UNC Asheville on a Saturday and got a job at the Asheville Citizen Times on Monday morning. The publisher called me and invited me in and gave me a job. So that's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Very cool. I had the honor, I don't know the honor. I had the very nice experience today of watching your documentary, Uneven Fairway. And is that the name of your book or the documentary or both?
That's the documentary. It's a combination of my book, Uneven Lies, and Dr. Sinnett's book, Forbidden Fairways.
Okay. So I just highly recommend, if you listen to this podcast, you're going to like this documentary because it's just filled with interesting piece of information about golf and the history of golf. And the main idea of the documentary is that there was a Negro League of golf, which I had never heard of. This is what, the 20s and 30s and 40s?
It started in the 20s all the way up until the 70s to be exact. And as a matter of fact, the Skyview Open is still being played.
Wow.
2021.
And because there was this clause, Caucasian only clause, in the PGA, with the PGA, so the black golfers started their own tour. On the porch of my house in Kiowa, Pete, I have a statue of Charlie Sifford, a bronze statue of Charlie Sifford as a boy swinging a golf club, and his swing never really changed. You can tell it's him by the swing, and the person who sculptured it did a very good job on it. But Aaron, you were going to ask some questions on it.
I have a lot of questions about that. I guess one question I have, and I just don't know the history of the systematic racism in America, but that clause that was so, you put it right up in the documentary. You can read it with your own eyes. It's right in the PGA guidelines that you can only play if you're Caucasian, which I guess also meant you couldn't play if you're Asian I can't even imagine sort of the ignorance of that clause.
Yeah, it was instituted. It was added to the bylaws of the PGA of America, which used to run the tour. In 1934, and I can give you the backstory to that as
sure.
well.
Yeah,
and it wasn't rescinded until 1961, and it basically said that in order to be a member in the PGA of America and compete in its events, its tournaments, you had to be a Caucasian male, not just a Caucasian. You couldn't be a woman, and you couldn't be a person of color. You had to be a Caucasian male, and that clause was in the bylaws for 27 years. During those years, you had all of these great black players, Teddy Rhodes, Bill Spiller, Charlie Sifford, unable to compete in PGA of America sanctioned events. Now, they were able to play in the US Open. They were able to play in the LA Open, certain events like the Canadian Open, events like that, who weren't under the auspices of the PGA of America. But PGA of America events didn't allow blacks to play. And so they started their own Association, the United Golfers Association, in 1925.
Yeah. I was trying to sort of understand the timeline of when the other sports leagues, the major sports leagues, became integrated, basketball and baseball. I mean, if PGA allowed for integration in early 60s, when did those other two leagues allow for it?
The 50s.
Yeah, in the 50s. Exactly. In the 50s. Jackie Robinson in, I want to say like 1950, maybe 55, 56.
Yeah, Branch Rickey brought him in back then. And then, you know, football players sort of flooded. Basketball players dribbled in.
Yeah.
Pun intended.
Well, you had Jim Thorpe in football. I guess they didn't consider him.
Yeah. He goes way back. You know who Jim Thorpe is, Aaron?
Yeah.
Jim Thorpe was an Olympian and just an outstanding Native American athlete, just all around athlete. And he played professional football.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Golf was the very last one. To integrate. And it took almost an act of Congress in order for that to happen.
Can you tell that story I guess it was Charlie Sifford and then the Attorney General in California.
Exactly. And his name escapes me right now. That's sad, but you know.
He was Jewish, by the way, Aaron. I think
exactly.
He was Jewish.
And the PGA of America was getting ready to hold its championship, the PGA championship, at a golf course in California. And the Attorney General told the PGA of America that it could not, unless it allowed Charlie Sifford and Bill Spiller and Teddy Rhodes and these guys an opportunity to play. And so they moved the tournament elsewhere. I think maybe to Michigan, and lawsuits, all kinds of stuff happened. And the other state's attorney generals joined in that cause, sparked by the California attorney general. And basically they shut the PGA of America down and forced them to remove that Caucasian only clause. And thus in 1961, Charlie Sifford gained his privilege to play on the PGA Tour, becoming the Jackie Robinson, quote unquote, of golf. And that's what opened it up for African-Americans to play on the PGA Tour. And behind him came Pete Brown, Lee Elder, and Jim Thorpe and Jim Dent and all these guys.
I sort of think of it too, Pete. When I think of wondering how good some of the black players who played in the Negro League and never mm-hmm. got to play in Major League Baseball, mm-hmm. how they would have competed and how they would have been. And I think about that same thing with some of the great black golfers who never got a chance to compete at Augusta. You know, mm-hmm. and there was some controversy around Lee Elder being named as one of the official, you know, starters for the Masters because he hadn't won a Masters, played in the Masters, but he came in sort of past his prime, and if you mm-hmm. think about how many Masters he would have played in prior to that and how many opportunities he would have had to win, and some of the other great golfers, how many opportunities they would have had to win that tournament if they were allowed to play in it.
Absolutely. Case in point is Charlie Sifford. When Charlie Sifford finally got his tour card, he was 39 years old, and yet he won twice on the PGA Tour. And for about, I'm going to say about 12 straight years, he finished in the money. He was among the top 60 money winners, which you had to be to retain your card back then, at 39 years old, all the way up till he was almost 50.
And how old was Lee Elder? How was Lee Elder
Lee was younger. Lee was probably in his early 30s when he finally, you know, got on tour. And when he won the Monsanto Open in Florida, in Pensacola, in 1974. And that's how he got his invitation to play in the Masters in 1975. But Charlie Sifford, to his dying day, you know, he really blasted the Masters. Didn't want to have anything to do with it. You know, because he claimed, and I think rightfully so, that he had been shut out of the Masters. He qualified. He was exempt to play in the Masters. And yet every time he became eligible to get an invitation, he said they moved the goalposts and basically shut him out. And there's proof of that. I mean, he wrote a letter to Bobby Jones just excoriating the Masters and you know, so he got on their quote unquote blacklist, and he never was invited to play, even after he won the LA Open. You know, and I think it was 1967 or 68. And he was very bitter about it. And his acceptance speech when he was inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame, he basically said he had five things that he wanted to accomplish when he was when he first started playing golf and he turned pro. I think he said one of them was to play, and then he wanted to play in a PGA Tour event.
Check.
He wanted to play in the National Open, the U.S. Open.
Check.
He wanted to play, I think, in the British Open. He wanted to play in the Masters, and then he wanted to play, and he wanted to be in the World Golf Hall of Fame. And he said four out of five.
Four out of five. Days. Four checks, yeah. one X.
That's exactly right. So discrimination, racial, the racist practices have permeated the game of golf from day one, to be honest with you. And that's going all the way back to like 1896 when John Shippen became the first African-American to play in a U.S. Open, the second U.S. Open at Shinnecock Hills.
And that wasn't without a lot of controversy.
That's exactly right. Oscar Bunn was a Native American, a fellow caddy. And they were the best players at Shinnecock Hills. And so the membership encouraged them to play in the tournament. And they said, okay, we'll play. Well, the rest of the field, who were Scots and other Europeans, balked at that. They said, pretty much, you know, if they're allowed to play, we're not going to play. So you can have a tournament. Well, Theodore Heffermeyer, who was the head of the PGA of America, no, the USGA, I'm sorry, who was the head of the USGA, said, look, guys, these young men are going to play. If they're the only ones in the field, he shut it down like that. And to the amazement of everyone involved, John Shippen, who was, how old, 16 years old at the time, shared the lead in the first round.
Yes. And you know what's amazing about some of these stories, too, Pete, is that the black golfers endured a lot. Mm-hmm. And never gave up. But there were also people who helped along the way, who worked to make these changes come about and became allies and worked at this to where we are today. It's a totally different experience. And I know the listeners may be tired of hearing about the fact that I played the top 100 golf courses in the country in a year, but and I'm writing about all that with my memoir, but people expected there to be a lot of resistance, that mm-hmm. I would have trouble not only getting access, but even if I got access, playing at some of these very elite clubs, but didn't have any issues whatsoever in that regard, just none at all. And even just riding down Magnolia Lane and thinking about all of those who paved the way that never got a chance to take that drive, that ride. Mm-hmm. And there's still a long way to go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you were talking about how most Black golfers started out as caddies.
Right.
And you look at some of the greats, they were caddies. And one of the, and you can speak to this, because I always say this, I haven't done enough research on it to validate it, but my view was that one of the unintended consequences of Tiger dominating the game mm-hmm. was that the money got so good that the Black caddies were pushed up. You know, it used to be you turn on the television and watch golf, Black caddies. And I think at Augusta, it was always, and Cliff Roberts said, there will always be white golfers and Black caddies.
Mm-hmm.
Now you rarely see a Black caddy on the tour. And there are actually fewer African-American golfers on the tour now than when you had, you know, Jim Thorpe and Lee Elder, Jim Dent, all those guys out there. Mm-hmm. Competing. What's your view on the fact that there aren't as many Black caddies, and is that affecting how many Black players there are in the PGA, on the PGA Tour?
It did. It certainly halted the progress. You know, the advent of the golf cart was the big culprit. A lot less expensive to have golf carts than it was to have caddies. People blame Tiger mm-hmm. and his emergence, you know, as a superstar for the decline in caddies because of the money situation. He definitely brought a whole lot more money into professional golf. His success was largely responsible for that, but that had very little to do with the caddy situation. It started long before him. It actually started at the Masters, because you're right. For years and years and years, the players were white, the caddies were Black. And there's a story about that. I don't want to indict anybody, but you can read about it, about what happened at Augusta National and when it happened. But a prominent player wanted to have his own caddy, his tour caddy. And that's how it started. And he was allowed to have his caddy. And then all of a sudden, all the other players wanted to have their caddies. All right. And so that high visibility that the Black caddies got, the Masters caddies got, which really encouraged a lot of people like myself to want to become a caddy, all of a sudden it was gone. Which was really a shame, because those guys were our heroes, to be honest with you. They were role models. Everybody wanted to be on TV one day. You could dream of caddying at Augusta National and be on TV, you know? And so that hurt. And also, you know, the fact is that a lot of the players, the younger players, wanted to have their friends caddy for them. You know, don't believe the stories about the Black caddies on tour being lazy and not showing up for tea times, and because that was one of the rumors. You know, and some of the people trying to justify the fact that the younger players wanted to have their own friends, their best friends or college teammates who couldn't make it on tour. The fact is that that's what they wanted. They wanted to have their own guys, brothers, other relatives, in-laws, you name it. That's who they went with. And that was a shame. And bags started disappearing and black golfers started to disappear in the process. So that's basically what happened. But as far as the number of young potential pros today, of course, you don't have as many on tour as you had in the 1970s, which we call the golden era of the black player. Because at any one tournament, you might have 12 or so blacks in the field, including Monday qualifiers. They did away with that. They made it the all-exempt tour, and that took care of that. You know, no more Monday qualifying. So you had no more rabbits. But you have something called the Abacus Pro Golf Association. Now, it's a breeding ground, developmental tour for young African-Americans and other players of color and white kids as well. They compete on the tour as well. It's kind of like the old UGA, the old golf tour that spawned Teddy Rhodes and Charlie Sifford and all those great players, in that it doesn't discriminate. If you got a game and you qualify to play, then you go out and play. It has already sent Tony Finau, Harold Varner, Joseph Bramlett played on it a little bit.
I'm trying to remember.
Champ.
Yeah, Champ.
Played on it as well.
This is the league, Aaron, that Maurice and I were sponsoring kids through the Grow the Game initiative from the APGA to play in the Corn Ferry and try to make the tour. But yeah.
I want to do like a where are they now from all of our previous podcasts, but definitely want to get a good update on Maurice Allen. I'm curious for both of you guys, just trying to bring this all together and the narrative of what we're discussing. But, you know, so Jimmy, just remind me again, the year that you did the top 100 was what, like 2012 or somewhere around that?
No, 2017 to 2018.
Okay. All right. So we're in modern era.
Right.
And then, and so in your experience was really race was not an issue during that, other than a few issues that happened outside the golf course. But when I hear about Tiger, once Tiger was at Stanford and once Tiger was on his way to being the dominant player, there were issues with security and things like that. But those are some crazy fans and people out on the golf course. But I guess my question is, you know, was this last, the sense I get is that growing up, and Tiger's the same age that I am, mid-40s, so I guess in the 80s and 90s, growing up as a black kid, race was an issue on the golf course, getting access, getting tee times, all the things that were spoken about in the HBO series. Today, if you are a 13-year-old kid of African-American heritage and you've got some pigmentation in your skin and you are living in Asheville, North Carolina, and you are an awesome golfer, what is the world like for that kid in terms of golf?
Depends upon the kid. So if you're Jimmy and Erica James's kids, you go to the country club and you get instruction and you're introduced to the world of people who will see how great you are, and they'll drop $100,000 a year for a few years to sponsor you on the tour, and the whole system works very well. If you're from the side of the tracks I was from as a kid, you're making your own golf clubs or finding some at a thrift shop or something, and you're playing out of Muni. And Muni golf is great. Muni golf is great, though. Let me make sure people understand that I belong to several top golf clubs. I still go and play at Muni's because it's just such a great experience. But you don't get the instruction. You don't get the same quality of tight fairways and manicured greens and that whole experience.
What I'm trying to bifurcate there is I get the socioeconomic divide. It's an unfortunate reality of how expensive the sport is, and that's like a different topic. But just purely on the race, you know, is that kid who's a black kid from the wrong side of the tracks, or the other side of the tracks, at a distinct disadvantage to the white kid who's also with him on the same side of the tracks today, as it relates to golf?
What you're asking is if racism still exists, and it does. I can tell you stories about my career. But I'll tell you those stories in just a second. If you are, as Jimmy said, if you're a poor black kid, you do have other options now, because there are junior golf programs around this country. A lot of them cater to minority kids. The first tee, in my opinion, the verdict's still out on that, because it started out as a way to introduce the game to inner city youth, mainly, quote unquote, black kids and kids of modest means. But now it's turned into something else. I don't know exactly what, I can't really define it. And it has been beneficial because it did introduce a lot of kids to the game. But there are opportunities for you to play, but it comes down to, as Jimmy said again, the kid himself. By that I mean, is it something that you're interested in? Is it something that compels you to want to play it and practice and be good at it? Tiger drove a lot of kids to the game, a lot of them. But what happened, in my opinion, was that he made it look so easy, you know, and that you could make a ton of money doing it. And, you know, and so the kids got out there and they found out golf is tough. It requires a lot of practice. You have to be mentally strong. You have to be willing to put in the practice time and really beat golf balls. And then you have to have good training, proper training, proper equipment. You have to be fitted properly. There's a lot that goes into it. And quite frankly, you know, this younger generation's attention span is not that great. You know, you have to dedicate your life to it. This is a little bit off the subject, but in my opinion, all great players from Hogan, from Byron Nelson, all these guys going back to the past, old Tom Morris, I guarantee you, all the way up to Tiger and Phil and all those guys, they were focused on one thing, being the best player that they could be. That means that they had tunnel vision. I don't know how they had time for family. I guarantee you somebody suffered along the way, because in order for you to be great at something, and I'm not just talking about good at something, I'm talking about great at something, there are a lot of sacrifices. You have to sacrifice some things that you might want to do over here. You can't do them because you're focused on getting that ball in the hole faster than anybody else. And I don't think this modern generation, for the most part, has that kind of patience or dedication to be good. Basketball? Oh, yeah. 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 Football? Yeah. Maybe not baseball, because that's a sport that requires a whole lot of time, too, to become great at it. So just in my humble opinion, the game is going to get better because you do have this Advocates Pro Golf Tour. You have other organizations that are willing to, you know, put some money into the game and other resources. You have professional athletes who are pumping money into some of the HBCUs, the historically black colleges and universities, and starting some of their golf programs up again. But golf is a great educational tool. It teaches you so much about life And even more than becoming a player, it teaches you how to become a better citizen, a better person. I've always said, if you can master golf, just the ability to play golf and not get frustrated and want to quit, if you can stick with it, I'll guarantee you it'll take you places where you couldn't even dream of. You'll meet people that you know, just like Jimmy was intimating. Go to a public golf course and you may be playing with a millionaire and not even know it. He's not playing a private club. He's enjoying a fellowship of average people, quote unquote, average people. You know, you meet people who can do things for you, who can suggest, if nothing else, a restaurant, a nice restaurant that you might want to go to, you know, and you've never even thought about going to this place. And this guy says, okay, come on, let's go have some drinks and you know, eat a nice meal. And there you are. And you get to sit around the table after your meal and you're talking and you find out you have something in common. You may want to be interested in doing something over here. And gosh, he's got to connect. He shoots you straight to it. And who knows what, you know? That's what golf does for you. It took a little country boy like me who had dreams, who told people that when I was, gosh, probably 12, 13, wanting to be a professional golfer, professional basketball. I want to be all the pros. You know, I was going to be everything, the greatest ever and everything. I told people that I was going to be rich and famous by the time I was 25. Well, 20, I didn't know how I was going to do it. 25 rolled around. Well, I wasn't rich, nor was I famous. I said, okay, well, by 30, you know, I'll be there by 30. 30 rolled around and I was on my way, but I wasn't there. 35 then, okay. 30, no, still wasn't there. 40, I said, I gave up on it at 40. I said, well, you know, I'll just make my mark somehow. Well, 45 rolls around and guess what? I wasn't rich, but I was famous. My share of fame. You know, I don't know if I ever got rich, but I got wealthy in experiences and you know, just life experiences. And that's where I am. And that's what I have to offer. That's all I have to offer.
You know, it is. I don't think there's a day that goes by, Pete, where I don't talk to someone that I met as a result of playing the top 100 golf courses. The number of people that I've met and the relationships that I've built, golf really does provide the opportunity to meet people you would otherwise not meet and build relationships mm-hmm. with. Mm-hmm. And so, Aaron, on your question, and Pete mentioned it, of course, racism is never going to go away. That's not, to me, even a realistic goal. That's part of just human nature. Unfortunately, it's the impact of racism that we want to eradicate. That's what we want to get. That's what we want to get rid of, to where it is an influence on someone's ability to achieve or excel, where it doesn't become a factor that a person, where they go in life, is determined by how many sacrifices they're willing to make, the skills that they have, the work they're willing to put in, those types mm-hmm. of things, instead of superfluous things that are meaningless. And so that, I think, is where we want to head. And there are a couple of things I want to read before we wrap up. Pete, I would say to people that I bet Michael Jordan is not the best basketball player on the streets where he grew up. And, you know, some people would think that I must have been the smartest kid that I grew up around. No. And I would venture to guess, weren't as great of a writer as you are. I'm going to read something that just illustrates that, that I thought was just a great line from your book. But there were probably better writers than you.
Mm-hmm.
and they didn't get the same sort of breaks, or they didn't have the endurance to go take it all the way. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're trying to eradicate, is the stuff that you shouldn't have to deal with, to where if you can do it, if you have the talent, if you have the capability, if you're willing to make the sacrifices, put in the hard work, that you don't have to deal with a whole bunch of other stuff that just at times makes you tired and want to give up. So I'm going to read a couple of things. One is from your book, and another is I'm going to just share just how, you know, I'm learning a lot about writing as I'm writing this book. But something your friend Michael Brumberger wrote, you know, I live in Philly, so Michael and I belong to the same club. Michael, for the listeners, is a writer also for Sports Illustrated.
Excellent writer.
Here's from your chapter 4, A Place of Their Own. Long mm-hmm. before the PGA Tour card became a gold carat and platinum passport to prosperity, those who aspired to play golf professionally were considered foolhardy souls with an aversion to dirty fingernails and sweaty brows. That to me sort of sums it up and defines the type of people that'll go all the way. Very, very well written. And this, we were at dinner one night, and you know, it was Michael joined us, Erica and I, my wife Erica and I, for our anniversary with some other friends. And someone who hadn't heard the story asked how Erica and I met. And I sort of told the story. And there's a part of it involves a book by John Grisham. So Michael knows John Grisham's agent. And so he wrote up something and sent it to him. But I just want to read this, we're talking to a writer here. And this just tells you how well, there's no way I could say this as well as Michael wrote this. It goes, about 30 years ago, one of Jimmy's colleagues told him his reading list, geological forecasts and the likes, was a cocktail party rally killer. The colleague gave Jimmy a bag of novels. Jimmy had never read a novel, so he read one from the bag, The Firm by John Grisham. One day in the springtime of his expanding mind, Jimmy saw a beautiful young woman at DFW with her nose in the same Grisham novel, and Jimmy had the path he needed to start a conversation. Then, as it happens, they were seated one row apart on a flight to Houston. Erica was, she said, going to take a connecting flight to New York. Jimmy left the airport, got outside, and realized the error of his ways. He hadn't even tried to get her name or number. He made a U-turn, got himself through security, checked the gates for the flights to New York. No sign of the woman. Then, making good use of his OCD, Jimmy decided to look at flights to Newark. There was a flight to Newark that had boarded, started out to taxi out, but as fate would have it, returned to the gate because of an engine problem. And on that flight was the Grisham reading woman. Jimmy made his move, and 5 years later in Houston, they became, to be archaic about it, Mr. and Mrs. Jimmy James. But it's, you know, to me, that's just so—it's so succinct and well. Just it tells the story. That's how I tell the story now. Mm-hmm. the ability to write is—it's a skill, and it takes.
And paint a picture. You have to paint a picture. I know exactly who you were then.
Yeah,
and I know who she was then as well. I could see it.
and I mean so. I read that and read some of yet that line from your book that we talk about the work it takes to be a golfer, mm-hmm. to be at the peak of your game in golf. It takes just as much dedication, just as strong of a mind to write well. And you write very well. So
thank you very much. I tell people, and it's, again, this is, I have all of these beliefs. You know, I don't care if anybody disagrees or agrees in my beliefs. I believe that, you know, writers are born. You have that gift. It's a God-given gift. And you can choose to to expand on it, or you can choose to ignore it and go in another direction. But it is a gift. I mean, that's the only way I can. I see people all the time who ask me about writing a book. They want to write a book. And I tell them, I said, well, I can tell you how to do it, but I don't know if you can do it.
Yeah, it's a lot of hard work.
Well, yeah, I can tell you structurally what you have to do, the process to get started and to finish it. But I don't know if anybody's going to read it or if it'll be a good book, but you can write one. But to be good at anything, Jimmy, I think you hit the nail on the head. You have to be focused on it and you have to be willing to fail.
Yeah.
Every great writer, I'll guarantee you, will tell you that they failed at least once.
Yeah.
They had an editor that they turned something in and the editor turned it right back around and gave it to them and told them to go work on it.
Yeah.
Now, they could have done one of or two things. They could have gone back and given it another try and really tried to make it better. Or they could have said, here, kids, I'm not going to do this. This is too hard.
Wow. Well, this has been really good. And we're going to have to do, there's so much we didn't get to. And we're going to have to do part two next year. So any other questions you want to ask Aaron before we wrap up here?
I have one last question, which is, so Samuel L. Jackson is the narrator to this documentary. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that you're friends with that guy? Have you played golf with him?
I've never played golf with him, but I'll tell you very briefly how that happened.
Okay.
The producers of the doc had a connect to get to Samuel L. Jackson. I actually wanted somebody else. I won't say who it was, but he said, Samuel L. Jackson. Okay, I said, okay, that sounds good. He plays golf and, he's a pro. So we fly out to L.A. to a studio and I meet Sam. And he's like 6'3", just a dominant figure. And I'll tell you how that script was written. I was in one room with my word processor and Sam was on the set. And I was firing that stuff off on the wing, just winging it, on the fly. And they were shooting it to him, putting it on the monitor. And he'd look 20 seconds. And then he'd memorize it. And that's wow. How it was doing.
Wow.
Wow.
Okay, we need this. Okay. We got this scene, Pete. Okay. I'd write it. And then shoot it to my guy, and they put it on the doggone monitor. And
wow,
look at it and, just kind of memorize it. And then I wrote something. This is a kind of a funny tale. I wrote something and I misused a word. And Sam said, Pete, you mean this instead of that? And I said, oh, yeah, that's right. I meant that. But he is absolutely brilliant and a wow. Funny guy, friendly guy,
Yeah.
He had his wig guy there too. He's been bald, I guess, for years and years and years. And his wig guy had this collection of wigs and he was showing them to us. It was fascinating. Great experience.
I guess there is one other thing that I wanted to mention to you, because you're friends with Tiger Woods family. Mm-hmm. I actually met his mother, and such a sweet lady. It was the 2015 Masters, and we were on like the 15th hole or so, and I look over and I see her, and I go, "You're mm-hmm. Tiger's mom," and so we just start talking, and she looks at her. I guess there's some guy that's a security guy, or whatever, and sort of. Waves him off, and we spend the next three holes chatting and talking together. She gave me a pin, the Tiger Woods Foundation pin. So it was just so kind and generous with her time. It was Really nice.
That's my girl. She calls me on my birthday. I call her on my birthday. We don't talk as much as we used to, but I, you know, I talk to her at least every other month, and she gives me such a hard time. That's the way you know whether Tiger's mother cares about you. She gives me a hard. I always ask. Just briefly, I remember, you know, I followed Tiger. I walked inside the ropes everywhere. And I was getting older, and you know, had leg problems, knee problems, and stuff. And so she bought me one of those little stick chairs, you know, from Augusta National, and gave them to me. And she said, "Pitt, I see you walking inside the ropes, trying to show off your pretty legs." I was wearing shorts. She said, "Shoot, honey, you old as hell."
Cover those legs up.
Basically, that's what she was telling me.
Well, it's been
thank
great.
Thank you, Tina. I appreciate it.
it's been great. It's been great, Pete.
Yeah, really thank you. I've had a great time.
Like I said, we're gonna have to do part two. So
we'll do it on the golf course. We'll do it on the golf course.
We'll do it on the golf course. When you're down, we're definitely gonna play Pete when it warms up again. And Aaron, you can come down and join us anytime.
Did you get my Aaron, email, by the way, you? Jimmy? I'm in New York. So we'll play up here. Yeah.
My favorite place.
Yeah. And I'll be this summer, I'll be in Philly this summer. So,
well, did you see, Jimmy? I'm following up on our Jake Arrieta email, on our Jake Arrieta podcast. I sent you an email. I don't know. You're a busy guy, so you might not have seen it, but I gave you the dates that hit. I see on the Padres are playing the Phillies.
Oh.
And I was like, yes, I looked it up. Teddy, my son, looked it up.
I didn't see that email.
Yeah. And I was like, can we try to play golf with Jake Arrieta on those days? Pete can be our fourth.
Yeah, I'll look for the email, and I'll connect with Jake, and we'll see if
okay, we can
make that happen. All right, guys, okay, it's been great. So, until next time. Well, a lot of history there, lots of history, Aaron. You know, this weekend, this past weekend, we recorded this right after that epic game of the Chiefs and the Bills, and I sort of felt that way, that sense of this is something really special, because just he has so much history and knowledge of the game, and just to have the opportunity to meet him, talk to him, and talk about all that stuff. Just a lot of fun, especially for guys like you and me that really love the game and really want to understand every aspect of it.
Well, I've always been broader than this podcast, which means nothing in the scheme of the world, but I think that the, you know, one of the lessons that we learn repeatedly is the serendipity of life, and you know, the fact that you and I know each other through golf and the serendipity that is our friendship, and you know, the serendipity that Pete was coming of age as a reporter in the mid 90s. He's an African-American guy covering golf, and this once in a generation thing happens in the sport, which is Tiger Woods, and he gets put onto that, onto that assignment. And the kid's just a college undergrad, and just this whole journey that he had from that one thing, that one assignment he got in 1994. It's wild.
It really is when you think about life, and you know, I still suffer from OCD in some ways, and I am a control freak, and you know, I plan everything and all this sort of stuff. But it's amazing, with all of that, life just happens, and you find your way to all these places and all of these experiences that go well beyond anything that you could have imagined for yourself.
Yeah, it's so true. You try to have a plan, but life is. I mean, it's almost makes the defeatist attitude of life. It's just life just happens. I mean, that story about Erica and you we need a separate podcast about that, because there's obviously a sequel where she comes off the plane and she files a restraining order.
No.
And then, you know, but that's an amazing story. That's an amazing story.
Yeah.
Well, pretty cool. Thank you for setting this up. And I look forward to Jordan making this beautiful and editing it all down to the way it sounds to our viewers, our listeners. And we'll talk soon.
So until next time, when we again talk to someone we've met because of this crazy game of golf and are traveling through it. Until next time.
Absolutely. Bye.